And now on to today's introductions. We are delighted to be joined by Dr. Lena Hillenberg, who is a board-certified physician in internal medicine and pediatrics, as well as hospice and palliative medicine. She earned her medical degree from University of Washington and then completed residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at Loma Linda University. Dr. Hillenberg worked primarily as a hospitalist for the first 15 years after residency before transitioning to full-time palliative care with Providence in 2017. And she currently serves as the palliative care heart failure liaison, where she's been working on improving palliative care access for our heart failure patients. She also serves on the palliative care justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion team. Dr. Hillenberg completed a master's degree in bioethics and health policy at Loyola University in 2022. She enjoys spending time outdoors, hiking, camping, and riding her two horses, Effie and Rabbit. Dr. Hillenberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Laura. As you mentioned, after I graduated from residency, I went into being a hospitalist, and that was in 2003. And I always think that's really interesting because that was the same year that the first palliative care fellowship started. And at the time, I didn't know really anything about palliative care. Maybe I equated it with hospice, but not much more. However, as a hospitalist for the next 15 years, and at the time, my average age patient was 84. Both I and my colleagues came to realize that we weren't given much training or tools on formulating a prognosis or how to use this to assist with patient care. And most of the content for this presentation originates from questions I and other colleagues have had over the years. And I hope you find this information as helpful as I have. So the objectives that I have for today's session is one, to learn about the guidelines and benefits of timely palliative care support for heart failure patients, to increase familiarity with the factors that contribute to a limited prognosis in patients with heart failure, and to improve confidence formulating a prognosis and recognizing when palliative care support is appropriate for heart failure patients. I always like to start with a case study. It's a real life person I saw at St. Vincent's a few years ago. She's an 84-year-old female. I saw her on her third admission in 4 months for shortness of breath due to heart failure. Her weight was stable, but her albumin was declining. Her comorbidities included diabetes and chronic kidney disease. She had noted a functional decline over the last 6 months despite treatment and was currently living a bed-to-chair existence. So we were asked to consult. After looking at patient's medical record, we found that she did qualify and was hospice appropriate. However, she and her family had no idea that heart failure was even a terminal diagnosis. One thing the patient said to me is, why can't they just give me more pills to fix it? One thing the family said to me, won't she be stronger if she just eats more? To me, it's really sad that someone learns they have a terminal illness and is discharged on hospice in the same hospitalization. The fact is that in spite of being subject to progressive physical disability, having survived many clinical crises, patients frequently fail to appreciate the seriousness of their condition. And later, their families are often shocked by what they perceive as an unexpected death. When I am talking to patients in our consults, we usually ask what patients are hoping for, what they're expecting for the future. And they often tell me things like they hope to be able to take their grandkids to Disneyland or a family vacation to Hawaii when they get better. They usually don't realize that they have progressive and eventually terminal diagnosis. And by now, they have no chance to do those bucket list items, since by the stage that I usually see them, they are too tired to do anything but sit and sleep. This patient and family would have been much better served if they had had better preparation for what the future holds. So what is the burden of advanced heart failure? So heart failure is the most common cause of hospitalizations in elderly Americans. It is a source of substantial suffering, like recurrent hospitalizations. It has a high symptom burden, such as dyspnea and fatigue. And when compared to patients with advanced cancer, it is considered to have a higher symptom burden than cancer. including declining functional status. There's a high financial burden, and there's a high burden on caregivers who are caring for these patients. So while this is all going on, patients and their caregivers often face decisions about high risk and complex treatments without adequate prognosis communication, decision support, or advanced care planning. Patients with advanced heart failure are significantly more likely to have more frequent ER visits, hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and delayed hospice admissions, are even more likely to die in the hospital than cancer patients. So one of the things that we've come up is what are the barriers to formulating a prognosis for clinicians? And these are concerns that I've told myself at some time or heard from other colleagues. Things like, I don't have a crystal ball. No one knows exactly when someone is going to die. Heart failure's disease trajectory is just too unpredictable to talk about prognosis. What if I'm wrong and the patient lives longer than predicted and they're upset with me for telling them that they were going to die sooner? It's difficult to think about my patient dying soon. And telling my patients their prognosis will only cause them to lose hope and make them depressed. So let's talk about what prognosis is. Prognostication is a process of synthesizing information from, one, knowledge of the natural course of the disease process, two, changes in functional status and domains, next is nutritional status, and then other clinical indicators to estimate a patient's remaining time of survival. And one of the things that we talk about when we talk about time and prognosis is not saying exactly when someone is going to die. Rather, it is recognizing usually the average survival for people in a similar situation. And not necessarily that individual, but people who are in a similar situation. I think another way a colleague put it to me is that it's like having a prognosis is like due dates for babies. Expecting parents are given a specific due date, but really few people actually expect a baby to be born on that exact day, knowing that most are born within a month of the due date. And doctors aren't faulting for being wrong when the baby isn't born on that exact day. It's not expected. It's known to be an estimate. And the point being that even estimates help families prepare and for clinicians to provide appropriate medical care, just like in prenatal care. Also, prognosis considers what the patient's health and quality of life will look like and change over time, as well as the likely benefit and burdens of various interventions and care plans. Even though one study showed that most, i.e. 70% of heart failure patients want to know expected disease trajectory and prognosis, most patients have a very limited understanding for both what life expectancy and what life will look like for them as they approach the end of their life. So this is a helpful visual tool I use to understand and explain what heart failure trajectory looks like over time. And this is using functional status rather than a clinical indicator like ejection fraction or lab value, because for the patient, it's what quality of life is based on. And so as you can see, this is physical function and this is time. And when I'm often talking with patients, I'll show them this graph and I'll say, you know, one stands for when most people are diagnosed and they feel fairly bad, but then we see them and we start them on medications, do some tests and procedures, start them on a diet and exercise program, and they feel better once all this is getting going. And we enter the plateau phase, where people's quality of life and physical function remains pretty stable because of that regimen that's helping to support the heart and make up for what the heart can't do. At the same time, we know that the heart is still getting weaker over time. It's just that this regimen is helping people live longer and feel better for as long as possible. This plateau phase can last weeks, months, and sometimes even years. However, eventually we get to a tipping point where the heart has become so weak that the treatment regimen can't make up for what the heart can't do anymore. And we start having crises. And this is what I call a roly-poly decline, because what happens is something happens, there's a tipping point, and someone start, you maybe wake up feeling really short of breath and go to the ER, stay in the hospital. We start to adjust your medication regimen, maybe get off a bunch of fluid in the hospital. And when you leave the hospital, you'll say, I feel better than when I came in, but I don't feel as good as how I did a month ago. And unfortunately, because of the stress of the crisis that happened, you won't be able to get back to your previous baseline. Some time will go by and there'll be another issue that brings you maybe to the hospital. And again, we do some adjustment, we get you feeling better, but it's not what how you felt before that hospitalization, maybe a month before that hospitalization. And as time goes on and your heart is getting weaker, we see a less response to treatment till eventually there's a crisis and the medications just aren't working. And if you're coming back to the hospital, you die in the hospital or at home. So that's the roly-poly decline. But one of the things is people say is heart failure trajectory is really unpredictable. And it's not so much that heart failure trajectory is unpredictable in character, it's rather that timeline can vary, but it's not that even that is not as often as many suppose. So this is one study that looked at patients during the retrospectively at patients during the last year of their life. And it looked at when did you start seeing that roly-poly decline? And what the study showed is that for about 79% of those patients in the last year of their life, that they entered that terminal decline and it was a prognosis of 1 year or less in these heart failure patients. So that's not everyone. About 21% did not show this roly-poly decline prior to the end of their life. But by far the majority are showing this roly-poly decline. So when patients enter this phase, most patients, about 80% of patients, it is an indicator of the last year of their life. And it is also shows what that last year will look like. So let's talk about the key elements of recognizing a limited prognosis. Often, when the term limited prognosis is mentioned in the literature, usually means likely less than 2 years. For the purpose of this lecture, I'll be concentrating on indicators associated with a less than 12-month prognosis, and I am excluding the prognosis for patients who are a candidate for advanced heart therapies like LVAD and transplant. So the first tool I want to talk about for recognizing a limited prognosis is the surprise question. Then looking at frailty, especially increasing frailty. And then looking at disease-specific clinical indicators associated with a worsening prognosis. So what is the surprise question? The surprise question is, would you be surprised if this patient died in the next 12 months? If the answer is no, you wouldn't be surprised if the patient died in the next 12 months. What does that mean? You know, this question was developed for clinicians of cancer patients, but it's been shown to be helpful for most chronic serious illness. And the reason why clinicians are generally overly, and we already know that in general, if we ask a clinician about a patient, especially a patient they have a strong relationship with, they are generally overly optimistic when they're asked to give a prognosis. Being overly optimistic doesn't make us bad physicians or clinicians. This is a normal response in humans with an intact ability to form relational and emotional bonds with other people, including our patients. But the surprise question is a way to get started on formulating a prognosis on an individual patient, but it can also take away the pressure of what if I'm wrong, or the guilt of predicting or ill-wishing about outcome. Or that optimism bias or fear of ill-wishing. It's basically, you're not saying the person has less than a year to live, you're just asking yourself the question, would you be surprised if they died in the next year? So how sensitive is the surprise question with heart failure patients? One study looked at ambulatory patients and physicians in a clinic, and physicians were asked, would you be surprised if this patient died in the next year? Physicians showed 85% sensitivity at identifying heart failure patients at the last year of life, meaning those patients that did die in the coming year, the clinicians were able to identify 85% of them. So this does not mean that everyone who says no to the surprise question, they wouldn't be surprised that they die. But what it does mean is that it's good at catching those people who are high risk of dying in the next year and likely will be having increasing supportive palliative care needs. So don't discount your own intuition. These type of results have also been shown for ER physicians in the ER when they see acute heart failure patient and they're asked that same question. This is another look at in the hospital. So looking at patients admitted for acute heart failure in the hospital, and this question was asked to cardiologists, training physicians, cardiology nurses, and non-cardiology nurses for 129 acute heart patients. Again, the cardiologists, they had about an 85% sensitivity in identifying a patient who would die in the next year. Cardiology nurses had the highest sensitivity in identifying patients with about 90% sensitivity. And I'm not surprised by this because those are the people that are spending the most face-to-face time with the patients over the next days that they're in the hospital. So I'm not surprised that they have a pretty good idea of where that patient's at. Cardiologists were also accurate in identifying patients who would live more than a year. So if they said, yes, I would be surprised if this patient died in a year, they were also usually right. So next thing I want to look at is frailty to assist with prognostication. And frailty plays a large role in the most likely prognosis of all our patients with serious illness, including heart failure. So what is frailty? Frailty is an age-related syndrome of physical decline characterized by 1, marked vulnerability, losing built-in reserves. And it leads to adverse health outcomes and long-term prognosis, such as recurrent hospitalizations and death. When we look at heart failure patients, all patients, around 10% of people aged over 65 have frailty, and it goes up with age to rising to be between a quarter and a half of those aged after 85. And most studies show a prevalence, generally over 50% of some degree in frailty of most people with heart failure, especially over the age of 60, which that prevalence goes up to as high as 84%. Now, increasing frailty is expected as people age, although the severity of frailty in individuals of a certain age varies greatly. Everyone is expected to become frailer from their baseline as they age. And worsening frailty and chronic disease usually means someone is coming closer to the end of their life. So let's look at the components of frailty. So one, you have comorbid conditions like older age, advanced chronic illness, recent hospitalizations, and declining nutritional status. And then it also looks at functional status, especially, like I said, declining functional status, such as activities of daily living, falls, and declining cognition. And this is not only for people who have dementia, but for people who may be developing a mild cognitive impairment as well. Now, there are many validated frailty assessment tools. This is a simple frailty score, and it uses the mnemonic FRAIL. And it basically looks at 3 areas: comorbidities, functional status, nutritional status. So the questions are for FRAIL: fatigue, are you fatigued throughout the day? Next is resistance, can you walk up a flight of stairs? Next is ambulation, can you walk a block? So that's looking at functional status. Then I for illness, does the patient have more than 5 of the following comorbidities? And then next is L, loss of weight. Have you lost weight unexpectedly in the last 6 months? Or do you see that evidence for that when you look at the chart? If a patient has 3 or more of these to say yes to, or 3 or more positive, then they're considered frail. Here are some examples of how frailty affects heart failure prognosis. So frail patients with heart failure have a 2.5 to 3.5 increase. So 2.5 to 3.5 times increase in 1-year mortality. And frail patients with only 1 heart failure admission have a 37% 1-year mortality. There's some other clinical indicators associated with frailty, like albumin or low albumin. And albumin is generally a measure of inflammation and malnutrition risk, and it's considered a clinical marker of frailty across disease states. In heart failure patients, albumin of less than 3.5 is associated with a 44% one-year mortality in HFrEF and a 47% one-year mortality in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And I think for me, this was surprising for me because as I'm rounding on my 85-year-old patient, I was thinking, who in that population has an albumin of more than 3.5? It seems really rare, especially in hospitalized patients, but it is considered abnormal. And this, when you have less than 3.5, that basically doubles your one-year mortality. Now let's look at a lower albumin. So an albumin less than 3.1, and that's associated with a greater than 50% one-year mortality, just looking at the fact that the patient has heart failure and an albumin of less than 3.1. It also is associated with a 2x increased 30-day mortality post-heart failure admission. There's some other clinical indicators associated with frailty. One is hyponatremia. Now, so low sodium is another clinical marker of frailty in various chronic illnesses. However, it has a very strong correlation with prognosis and heart failure. So if you have a sodium of less than 135, again, pretty common in our elderly patients, that's associated with doubling the one-year mortality from 15% to 30% when compared to other heart failure patients who have a normal sodium. And then when you look at heart failure patients with a sodium of less than 125, that is, again, basically doubles the mortality rate, and it's associated with a mortality rate, a mortality of 164 days. Let me just highlight, a sodium of less than 125 in a heart failure patient is associated with less than a 6-month prognosis. This is a sentinel event for heart failure patients. Other labs associated with poor prognosis in heart failure include higher creatinine, uric acid, CRP, BNP, and also lowering of some lab values like cholesterol and hemoglobin. I want to go over some of the guidelines across disease states that hospice uses as indicators for less than a 6-month prognosis. As we can see, the first four are basically assessing for frailty, weight loss, dependence on ADLs, declining functional status, and these lab values that are associated with increasing frailty. Then you also get recurrent or refractory serious infections and a hypoxemia, which are comorbid conditions and also part of increasing frailty. So what is one of the things that I want to look at is how we see that patients with heart failure that are frail have a higher burden of disease when compared with patients with heart failure who are not frail. So what we see when we look at patients with heart failure that are frail, they have higher family and friend anxiety, and more of a symptom burden, such as weakness and shortness of breath. And you can see here, the red is the frail patients and their scores, and then the non-frail patients here with heart failure and their scores for disease burden. So I want to look at some disease-specific clinical indicators for a limited prognosis or less than 1-year prognosis. So what I'm going to be looking at is declining GDMT tolerance, and GDMT stands for goal-directed medical therapy, and it's medications in heart failure that have been shown to improve prognosis, heart failure hospitalizations, and worsening renal function. So again, goal-directed medical therapy includes the alphabet cocktail of beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, ARNI, ARB, MRA, SGLT2I inhibitors, and nitrates. This does not include patients who are not on GDMT because it was just never initiated for whatever reason. But this is looking at patients who have been on GDMT, but these are being pulled back for any reason, which is usually due to hypotension and or renal failure, which are also contributors to frailty, by the way. So this is a look at a couple of examples of the effect on disease trajectory when we remove GDMT. So one study looked at beta blockers in hospitalized patients with heart failure, and if the beta blocker was removed, it increased readmission and mortality and 90-day mortality. And then withdrawal of an ACE inhibitor or ARB was associated with an increased readmissions, it doubled the 30-day mortality, and increased one-year mortality when compared with those who continued on the ACE inhibitor or ARB. And this is that study looking at 90-day post-hospitalization for people who had beta blockers removed. And I think it's really helpful because it shows the red line being the patient came in the hospital, they were on beta blocker and it was withdrawn, and compared to mortality rate over the next 90 days of other patients, we can see a marked difference. And even more than people who were never put on beta blockers, either before or after hospitalization. So next, I want to look at how heart failure admissions affect a likely prognosis. And I clearly remember being a second year med student and sitting in lecture and being told that an average life expectancy after diagnosis of heart failure was 2 years. But it being 1998, we were told there's a new treatment being started, like beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, and later other GDMTs. So I always assumed that the trajectory of heart failure had markedly improved. Until I saw this study that was published, and it looked at survival rates 1, 5, and 10 years between the years of 2000-2017. And what we see is there's some improvement, but that line is remarkably flat, or much more flat than I thought it was. So there's not this huge difference, even with GDMT, when we look at survival, long-term survival. However, that same study decided to say, let's break down patients into those who were never hospitalized versus those who have had at least one hospitalization, and let's look at their survival afterwards. And what it shows is that those who are not admitted to the hospital, they have a much better improvement in survival versus those who have been admitted to the hospital. It's that flat line that we see. And post-hospitalizations where we've seen less benefits for treatment advances. And I think this is because when someone gets to the point of their heart failure, it has advanced to the stage where they're coming to the hospital and respiratory distress, maybe have 20 pounds of fluid on them, that is an indicator that they come to a stage of heart failure where it has caused so much end organ damage that the positive effect of GDMT is less marked. So let's look a little bit closer of what prognosis after heart failure hospitalizations looks like. So number of admissions. So if you have two or more heart failure admissions in a 12-month period, that is associated with almost a 50% one-year mortality. And the more admissions that you have cumulatively and in a 12-month period is associated with increasing one-year mortality. By the time you get to 4 admissions in a year, that's associated with about a 70% one-year mortality. Next is looking at the severity of illness in the hospital. So if someone is in the hospital and has cardiogenic shock, that again in itself, one hospitalization with cardiogenic shock is associated with about a little over 50% 12-month mortality. Length of stay also affects mortality, going up to the point where it's been shown that when a patient is in the hospital for 22 consecutive days for heart failure, that is associated with 100% one-year mortality. Age also affects mortality rates, which we'll look at later, as well as comorbidities. So this is a large Medicare study that looked at prognosis after the first heart failure admission for patients over 65 years old. And one of the first things I noticed about this graph is that if you have heart failure with one admission and compared to the general population who does not have heart failure, likely life expectancy is much lower, like a 15-year difference, even in our youngest patients. What I also notice is that this shows heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, preserved ejection fraction, and borderline ejection fraction. And I was always under the impression that preserved ejection fraction had a better better survival rate, when it's really, it's not that different. Like maybe better on the order of a few months, but not much more. And what we also see is that as the patient ages, after their first hospitalization, mortality increases. So that 90-year-old patient, even if it's their first admission for heart failure, that is a marker for less than a one-year mortality. This looks at hospitalizations, what the mortality is, and it breaks down by age groups, so 65 through 85 plus, and it looks at what their expected mortality is, one-year mortality after each subsequent hospitalization. So these are lifetime hospitalizations. And what you can see is that after every hospitalization, mean survival goes down. And that the best survival again goes down with, as expected, with age. And then looking at how comorbidities affect survival after a heart failure hospitalization. And this is looking at those patients with heart failure and dementia versus those who don't have dementia, and what their survival is after each hospitalization. And what we see is that those with dementia have basically a 30% shorter expected survival than those heart failure patients without dementia. So, and this brings us to what I think is the most significant comorbidity, or rather end-stage complication of heart failure: worsening renal function. And again, this is another chart which looks at those heart failure patients who have hospitalizations without CKD and those with. And basically what we see is that CKD in heart failure hospitalizations doubles the expected mortality rate. And by CKD, that's defined as a GFR less than 60 or a creatinine of 1.5 or above. Again, I'm noticing that that's not horrible kidney disease, but it's significant, its impact is significant. So when we look at cardiorenal syndrome and prognosis, so CHF patients who develop cardiorenal syndrome have a much worse prognosis. And these are people who may have some underlying CKD, but their CKD is markedly worsening in the presence of worsening heart failure. And so an increase in creatinine of greater than 0.5 or a decrease in GFR of greater than 15, that triples the increased mortality risk. And in heart failure, a creatinine greater than 1.5 or GFR less than 53 is associated with a 51% 12-month mortality. This is one of those other indicators that someone may be coming to the last year of their life. So, you know, but wait, we have dialysis, right? And I always thought this could be used to mitigate poor prognosis associated with cardiorenal syndrome. However, we have a couple of large population studies done in the UK and Netherlands, which tell a different story. And what it showed is that if you're 75 years or older with ischemic heart disease, starting dialysis showed no survival benefit. Again, for a 75-year-old or older with ischemic heart disease, starting dialysis and renal failure showed no survival benefit. Also, there was no dialysis survival benefit for patients who were even over 70 if they had poor functional status. When we look at heart failure and diabetes and a GFR less than 20, that's associated with a less than 6-month prognosis with or without dialysis. And this is comparing dialysis to conservative medical management. One study showed that transition to dialysis in patients with cardiorenal syndrome was associated with a 95-day median survival. So only a median survival on dialysis, which I question is probably close to what their survival would be without dialysis. And then I just want to talk a little bit more about what are the signs of a 6-month prognosis. I've concentrated on 12-month prognosis, but you may be wondering, what about understanding when a patient qualifies for hospice. And I think this is important because, unfortunately, most heart failure patients don't access the hospice benefit until the last 2 weeks of their life. And this is usually because they're not told that this is accessible to them before then. So Medicare guidelines for qualifying for hospice due to a less than 6 month prognosis and are optimally treated for heart disease, meaning you've put them on or tried to put them on optimal GDMT. And they're stable as much as they'll be on that. And this includes if you're taking them off GMDT, that still means that they're optimally treated if they don't tolerate it. And then they should have meet NYHA class 4 disease, which just basically means they're symptomatic at rest with things like dyspnea, hypoxia, severe fatigue, and discomfort increases with physical activity affecting ADLs. Now, these criteria are not exclusive to other factors that affect prognosis, which we've already discussed. Basically, if you have any reason that you can back that a patient has less than a 6 month prognosis, they qualify for hospice or a combination of reasons, but this is specifically some listed criteria for heart failure. And again, CMS gives general guidelines for hospice, and that's general disease progression of any disease, including heart failure, with these markers of increasing frailty. So even if you don't have quite might meet this criteria, but you meet this criteria, the patient likely will qualify for hospice. So what's the take-home message? When is my patient at high risk for less than a 1 year prognosis? And so what I propose is that one, asking, would I be surprised if this patient died in the next year? And if the answer is no, that's something to think about. Looking for increasing frailty, such as advanced age, declining nutritional status, and multiple comorbidities, and looking at disease-specific indicators, such as heart failure admissions, worsening renal function, not tolerating GDMT. If the patient has one or more of these that you say yes to, then I would seriously think about whether this patient has less than a 1 year prognosis. But again, prognosis is not only about time, it's about what that time looks like. As quality of life declines and even aggressive treatments increase with decreasing benefit, we see that palliative care support needs greatly increase. So you can see quality of life functional status is declining, this roly-poly decline. Traditional care is becoming less effective even as we increase aggressiveness. And so when this is happening, we know that their need for supportive palliative care is rapidly increasing. So why is prognostication important? So most heart failure patients don't know their prognosis. One survey of heart failure patients shows that when asked, what a patient with heart failure think the eventual outcome of heart failure will be, almost half reported, quote, a normal life expectancy. They were not even aware that this is a progressive and terminal disease. But when clinicians identify patients with a likely limited prognosis in heart failure, they can appropriately inform patients and their loved ones, and they can provide timely and appropriate palliative care support. And when I say palliative care support, I am not just talking about specialty palliative care support from someone like me or my teammates, but also primary palliative care that can be provided at primary care offices, primary cardiologists, by physicians, PAs, MPs, nurses, social workers, et cetera. So what are the benefits of timely palliative care? One is advanced care planning, so enabling patients to guide the kind of care they will receive if and when they can no longer make their own decisions. Most patients we see don't have any goals of care or surrogates preference documented in their chart. And also family and loved ones usually don't have any idea of what future needs will be, let alone a plan for providing additional caregiving support. We can also discuss disease trajectory to plan and prepare for future medical and caregiving needs. As I said, most patients would like to know what their disease trajectory is and prognosis is. But when we've done one study that looked at patients that their cardiologists, in fact, did think they had less than a 12-month prognosis, and then we asked the patients what they thought their prognosis was, they all stated that they thought they had a 5-year or greater prognosis. So there's this discordance of what their clinician thought and what they thought. Also, when you can recognize this prognosis with increased symptom disease burden, you have better symptom management that has been shown to improve quality of life, spiritual well-being, less anxiety, and depression. So I think that fear of telling someone a prognosis and that causing them to lose hope or depression is legitimate, but when it's coupled with palliative care support, the opposite has been shown. And it also saves money on a value-based care system. So what we've seen is that palliative care support in heart failure patients in many studies has been associated with less ER visits when compared to those patients that have not had palliative care support, less hospital admissions, less ICU days, less intubations, less hospital deaths. It's also associated with significant decrease in medical utilization and hospital charges. One study showed that a quality goals of care discussion saves on average medical utilization of $9,500 per patient per year. And then the question is, what about survival benefit? Does palliative care have a survival benefit? So let's talk about hospice again. When heart failure patients who have likely less than a 6-month prognosis take advantage of that robust hospice benefit, what we see when we compare patients in the same stage of heart failure who do not enroll in hospice, that patients with heart failure report a higher quality of life than those who continue in usual care. We also see that enrollment in hospice after a second hospital admission is also again associated with less utilization, and as well as longer survival. I think I get a big surprise for myself and other people when they think about this, because most people think of having to sacrifice time for quality of life when enrolling in hospice. However, the data suggests otherwise. What we've seen is that when patients are able to take advantage of hospice benefit as soon as they qualify, this is associated with an average survival benefit of hospice for heart failure patients, ranging from 9 to 81 days. Now, that's not a huge survival benefit, but what it does show us is that continuing usual care with that revolving door in and out of the hospital, that has not been shown to provide a survival benefit in heart failure patients. You know, I've been reading a lot about gaps in health equity seen in minoritized communities. And one thing that is frustrating is that I rarely see evidence of interventions that can help close this gap. However, we've seen some of that in palliative care. So some of the health equity gaps we see is, for instance, the self-identified Black and Hispanic patients have a higher incidence of heart failure than other racial groups. Black patients have shown to have the highest burden of new onset heart failure with the most hospitalizations and the highest heart failure death rates when compared with patients of other racial groups. However, Black patients who receive palliative care support show a bigger increase in quality of life than white patients. So it's really nice to see some intervention like palliative care support can actually help close that health equity gap. So this strong evidence for benefit of palliative care to support heart failure patients has led to a class one recommendation in the 2022 heart failure treatment guidelines from the American Heart Association. And this class one is the same level of recommendation alongside other treatments with strong evidence, like GDMT or getting an echo or cardiology consultation. So what is included in this recommendation? So it is recommending palliative care support for all patients with heart failure, regardless of their prognosis. And it recommends including high quality communication, conveyance of prognosis, clarifying goals of care, shared decision-making, symptom management, and caregiver support. And it should be provided to improve quality of life and relieve suffering. And again, this is recommended for all heart failure patients, and it's not just from specialty palliative care, also primary palliative care in cardiology clinics and primary care clinics. But when these needs and the burden of disease gets complicated or a lot higher, that's when specialty palliative care support can be most helpful. So you may be wondering how to access palliative care for our patients with heart failure. So there are multiple ways in the Providence system. So one is in primary care, many PMG clinics have palliative care champions with special training and palliative care skills that can help provide palliative care support. So if you're wondering how your clinic can better provide palliative care support to your heart failure patients, ask and see if you have a palliative care champion that might be able to help come up with a primary palliative care plan. Next, you can do outpatient referrals to specialty palliative care, and they can do home visits in the Portland metro region or remote visits to anyone in Oregon, anywhere in Oregon. Also, heart failure patients connected with Providence Cardiology Clinics, we have an embedded specialty care team with a physician or NP and social worker that any patient that's connected to a Providence Cardiology Clinic can have access to. And then of course, at all our metro region hospitals, we have specialty interdisciplinary teams that are available for inpatient palliative care consultation. And I've had primary cardiologists, primary clinicians who have noticed when a patient goes in may think this may be the best way for them to get palliative care support, and we'll ask the attending physician to put in a referral. Finally, if you are interested in improving your skills and having conversations about prognosis and disease trajectory with your patients with heart failure, Providence Connections, we offer a half-day course on how to effectively have goals of care conversations about serious illness. It's taught by Vital Talk trained facilitators, including myself. It's free. It earns 3.5 hours of CME, and it's open to all Providence caregivers from any disciplinary, whether it's physician, MP, PA, nurse, social worker, et cetera. Here's the email if you're interested in that, where you can get more information about registering. And I think Stephanie is going to be putting that email in the chat for people who are interested. So I'd like to end in another case study. So this patient is a 71-year-old man with an EF of 25%, advanced COPD on O2, and chronic kidney disease stage 3. He had 3 hospital admissions for heart failure in the last 12 months. And during the hospitalization, we saw that he had suboptimal diuresis, continued dyspnea at rest, and intolerance to GDMT. So palliative care, specialty palliative care, myself, were consulted. We met with the patient and we had a discussion regarding his disease trajectory. We clarified his goals, which were to maximize functional status, and he prefers not to return to the hospital. He was discharged home with home health. He had a CardioMEMS placed for remote monitoring and better heart failure management. He's referred for assistance in getting additional caregiving support and planning for future needs. At cardiology clinic, the palliative care team followed up and they helped the patient complete a pulse. They assisted with energy conservation strategies, and they had further discussion about when hospice care would be a good fit for him. So what was the outcome? So this patient did stay out of the hospital, went home, and was able to stay out of the hospital for another 6 months. However, after 6 months, he returned for another heart failure exacerbation. He was discharged, but then came back within a month for another exacerbation. At that time, the patient, remembering previous conversations with palliative care, he himself asked his hospitalist if he could have a hospice referral, as he didn't want to continue to return to the hospital. He was able to be discharged quickly because he had already arranged additional caregiving support for home. And 3 months later, he died at home with hospice support. This is an example of the difference timely and appropriate palliative care support can make so that we can keep Providence's promise to know me, care for me, ease my way. Thank you for your time, and I'm wondering if you have any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Hillenburg, for your presentation. We'll turn to a few questions in the remaining time. Here is one commenting, for a sodium less than 125 and a creatinine greater than 1.5, are these parameters only useful in heart failure patients or all patients who should be referred to palliative care?
Well, definitely low sodium, especially less than 125, is a marker of increased mortality with pretty much any chronic serious illness. But the showing that a low sodium of less than 125 has specifically only been that is associated with less than a 6-month prognosis, it's really only been shown for heart failure specifically. When it comes to increasing creatinine, again, that also is a marker for increased mortality. I don't have the statistics on hand, but I would say that yes, it does show that there's increasing disease burden of whatever their chronic serious illness is, and that they're going to need increasing palliative care support. And so again, that always starts with the resources we have available in the primary setting, but when those are not adequate, or sometimes we know they're not available, then referral to specialty palliative care is the next step.
Great, thank you. Here's another question from online. Do you think heart failure patients understand that the aim for medications is to slow the trajectory of decline and that the heart failure gets worse despite the medications? Or do you think the average patient thinks the medications halt the heart from weakening further? Could providers be clearer in setting expectations at the outset?
Yeah, we know, both from when I look at studies and my own personal experience, that most patients do not know that even when they're doing everything right, when they're following their regimen, they're doing the diet, exercise, they're taking all the medications, they do not understand that their heart failure will continue to progress and their functional status will continue to decline. Most patients, again, think that they will have a normal life expectancy if they follow the treatment plan.
And any tips that you might suggest, ideas to mitigate that, mm-hmm. both perhaps from primary cardiology, but also from primary care, mm-hmm. Language or ideas or timing to help frame expectations?
So when I was a hospitalist and I would see someone for a heart failure admission and I was meeting them and talking with them, whether it's their first admission or their fifth admission, one, I would just ask them, what do they know about their heart failure? And that's when I would really get a sense of what their understanding of the disease is. And I just would make sure that they understood, even if it's in the office having their first, diagnosis of heart failure, to say, we're going to put you on a plan that helps you feel better for as long as possible and to live as long as possible. But we also know that even with us doing everything we can, heart failure, it will get worse with time. And these medications help slow that down, but it doesn't stop that. And so if they just know that basic fact going into their heart failure course, I think that opens a lot of room for more conversations as the burden of their disease increases.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And thanks for acknowledging the amount of the importance and the amount of palliative care done in the primary care setting and, of course, the cardiology setting. Could you comment a little bit on capacity and access for outpatient connections, specialty mm-hmm. palliative care, what mm-hmm. We might expect when a patient is referred? Mm-hmm.
So for Providence in the Oregon region, we have access to specialty palliative care as an outpatient for the entire state. If you're in the Portland metro region, that could include a home visit from our palliative care team, which is a nurse practitioner and social worker. If you're outside of the Portland metro region or even in the Portland metro region and you prefer a remote visit, that is available to all Oregon patients in Oregon. And so, like I also said, if you're if a patient is connected to a cardiology clinic, they have access to the palliative care team there, whether it's an in-person clinic visit or remote visits are available, again, for the entire organ, state of Oregon. You can put in an order, and I've been told that at this point, we're booking appointments a couple of weeks out. So they can be expected to be seen by that outpatient team within a couple few weeks. That does vary. So sometimes we have busier seasons than others, like everyone else. So sometimes that wait is longer.
Great. Thank you so much for clarifying that. This may be a complex and nuanced answer, but often primary care physicians are referring patients to hospice themselves, specifically patients with heart failure. Any comments in broad strokes on medications that are most useful to continue versus stop when thinking about focusing on symptom management in heart failure patients?
So yeah, that's a really good question. So one is the use of diuretics. As long as they're urinating, we should be using diuretics for as long as they're urinating to help improve their symptoms, especially shortness of breath. When diuretics are no longer working or not doing enough to where they're not completely treating their shortness of breath, then use of opioids for shortness of breath is very helpful. When we're talking about GDMT, all of those medications, all of them, have not only been associated with prolonging life, but they've also been associated with decreasing symptom burden. So when we think of hospice as comfort care and giving continuing medications that will decrease symptom burden, if, and this is a big if, because most of my referrals are no longer tolerating most or all GDMT, but if they're still tolerating the GDMT, I would like them to continue. As we might know that some of the GDMT like ARNIs and SGLT2I inhibitors can be really expensive. I've actually been talking with our hospice team about what we can do to continue access to those medications to hospice patients. Although I really, until very recently, I probably had a couple of patients that were still tolerating the SGLT2I inhibitors that actually were still tolerating and when they went on hospice. So again, it's really rare, but I think it's something that we need to improve access for because it does improve quality. It's been shown to improve quality of life in even terminal heart failure patients.
Great, thank you. That clarification is super helpful. I'm noticing we've gotten through our questions here in the chat and are coming up right at 9 o'clock. So again, we can send out with our follow-up email information about the available classes as well as referral. Thank you so much, Dr. Hillenburg, for teaching us today.
Thank you.